Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Chef's Story, and this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center in New York and California. But we're in New York, and today we are broadcasting from Roberta's Restaurant down in downtown Bushwick, Brooklyn. And I am so excited because I don't know him very well, but I'm a fan. We have Chef Dale Talde with us. Talde.
Yes,
Talde. And he's got such an interesting background. He's originally from Chicago. He worked at Vong, Spring, a lot of restaurants in Chicago. But probably the ones that you would know are Morimoto and Budokan, I think maybe down in Philadelphia, was that?
No, here in
New York.
Manhattan, yeah.
In New York. And he was the director of Asian Concepts for Star Restaurants. But if you know him, you probably know him from being on Top Chef. And he was not just on Top Chef once, but he was in also the All-Star season. And he has incredible accolades. He's been chosen by Food & Wine magazine as one of the top New York City, the top New York City chef. We, you know, and this is the most incredible thing. He has opened 3 restaurants in 1 year. This we've got to get into this. This is something I've never seen in my profession. So, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Wow. So, actually, you've done a lot. You've been a chef for and cooking for a while. You went to the Culinary Institute of America back in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And so, tell me where did you grow up in Chicago?
Yeah, I'm born and raised in Chicago. You know, my parents had a house out about 20 minutes northwest of downtown Chicago, a place called Niles. And, you know, I'm a first-generation American, and, you know, my parents are Filipino, so I think that's kind of where it all started for me, like really seeing a different culture through food. Like, you know, I grew up eating real, you know, just real Filipino food all the time. It wasn't...
Were your parents able to get the products in Chicago?
You know, they were. There's a large population of Filipinos in Chicago. And legal or illegal, they were growing whatever they could, you know, from back home that
right.
they can get here and grow in their backyard. But, you know, they made the best of what they could. But they tried to stay as authentic as possible. You know, my parents really enjoyed eating the flavors of the food that they grew up eating. So there was no like.
Did they both cook?
No, just my mother primarily cooked, but there was certain things that my father did cook. You know, like he cooked these. It's called beefsteak, and it's essentially a steak, but it's, you know, it's hammered to death. It's cooked all the way. It's a ton of onions, ton of garlic, a little bit of soy sauce. But he cooked a few things that he
had specials.
Yeah. Those were her.
Did you go back to the Philippines with them? And
yeah, when I was about 10 or 11, I went back. My grandfather passed away, so we went back home, and it was kind of like this real culture shock of going back to a country that is, I mean, it was so foreign at that age.
You had been sort of living. When you went to school, did your mother pack a lunch?
She did, and
what was in it?
You know, like, and I think I pull a little of this reference from a friend of mine, Eddie Wang, is that, you know, when I was in school, and if my mom did pack my lunch, it was very foreign, and it was like you're almost embarrassed that like you had adobo and rice and, you know, pancit, or with noodles, and every other kid was eating a sandwich, and like you know, you open this Tupperware, and people were like, oh, what's he eating? That's kind of weird, and it smells, and it's funny. And you just wanted to have a sandwich. You just wanted to fit in.
Right.
So kind of that's
I remember Rocco DeSpirito telling me that his mother used to make him, you know, paninis and with soppressata and peppers and everything. And he, people would look at him weirdly, and he'd trade them off for peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah, I mean, really, it's that's the kind of atmosphere it is when you're when you're growing up. You know, you're 8 or you're, you know, 7, sure. 8, 9 years old, yeah. And you just want to fit in. You want, you know.
Did you ever trade it for?
No, there was no trading. There was not at that age. Not I mean, at, no, yeah. I had what nobody wanted.
Were there any other Filipinos?
Yeah, and that's the funny thing is that there were a lot of Filipinos, but we all kind of like, I guess we didn't have a sense of who we were at that point. You know, when we got to high school, it yeah. became more of a, there was more of an association, like, you know. A
cultural identity.
Exactly. Because there was a large Filipino, you know, there was a Filipino club. We had, I was in a large high school called Main East, and it was a big school. Like when I graduated, there was 1,000 kids in my class.
Wow.
So it was a large high school, and there was a Filipino club, an African-American club, a Greek club, a Korean club. So, you know, the Filipinos that were around, and if you did have lunch with these Filipinos, like, we banded together, and it was like, hey, what did you bring? Did, you know, yeah. did your mom make something? And you know, someone would say, hey, my mom's making arroz caldo, which is like a chicken rice. It's basically like congee, mm-hmm. like a chicken rice soup. Mm-hmm. Oh, my mom's making that tonight. Bring some to school tomorrow. So we would band up together, but it wasn't until like, you know, junior
did
senior
any
year.
Other thing other than food band you together as tightly as the food for, did?
And I mean, this is a very strange kind of, I think, cultural thing that happened to Filipinos of my age, but like smooth R&B and hip hop.
Like really? Smooth
R&B, like Boyz II Men, like really, and then, you know, not like traditional R&B, but like, you know, early 90s R&B music, like, we latched
You're
onto that
hard. You're
giving
away your age here.
I am. I'm like, I'm 34. But, like, we all dug into it, and it was, like, it was funny. And that and dance, and, like, you know, like, a lot of the kids in of my, I think, to my
so
generation.
So, basically, music and food is how, but it wasn't Filipino. The thing that yeah. was Filipino. So, was it the Filipinos that dug the same music?
Yeah. I think, I use this as a reference, is that, you know, in the media, a lot of people can see someone who looks like them and attach themselves to, like, hey, you know, if you're African-American, hey, Michael Jordan looks like me. Mm-hmm. And there's someone I can identify in the media that looks like mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. Filipinos don't have that. And we still kind of don't have that. We're starting to get that. Mm. That, like, hey, there's that person on TV. There's that person.
Like you.
Kind of. You know, I think it's a...
But I mean, you on Top Chef.
Sure.
And the influences that, you know, were in your food. So you're young. Did you have a palate for American food when you were young?
Of course. I think every kid had a palate for, like, I want McDonald's.
Sugar and salt.
Yeah, that's what we wanted. And I had a palate for it. But, you know, what I always say is that, like, when I was at home, it was always chicken adobo, oxtails and, you know, oxtail stewed in peanut sauce and, like, fish head, you know, a sour tamarind soup with fish heads. But as soon as I left there, you know, I went to school and it was square pizzas and tater tots. And that was like...
the beauty of American cuisine.
But yeah, but that was like our, you know, that's kind of... And really that's how kind of what we do at Taldi. Yes. That's how a little bit of that is kind of is how that fusion or that mix of food and cultures comes together.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you get to the culinary?
You know, I always tell the story. My mom's like, I know, I don't remember that story at all. But she's like, you know, like I came home one day and it was really that sour tamarind soup with fish heads. It's called sinigang. And I was like, I don't want to eat that. And my mom, you know, my poor mother. I mean, she had 3 kids, all of us like really whiny. But she was like, you know, she worked the overnight shift as a nurse.
Oh.
God bless her. And she worked 16-hour days sometimes as an overnight, you know, as an RN. Mm. And then would come home, cook and clean for the family. And then for one of her kids, like, I don't want to eat that. So she's like, I cooked. That's what it is. If you right. don't want to eat, then make it yourself. And I was like, I want pancakes and I want apple pancakes. So she's like, then make it yourself. So I looked at the box and was like, this can't be that hard. Mm. So then I was like, probably like 10 or 11. And I made pancakes for dinner. And I was like, I think that kind of was like, that's it.
So then you ate pancakes for the next 8 years?
No, I had for that one night, and then I was like, you know what? I really want rice now.
you cured yourself.
Correct.
Right. So you're in high school. Where did the chef idea come in? What'd you do? I mean, did you always go right to culinary from high school?
I did. But it was always one of those things that are like, one of those things, I was always interested in food. I would get home from school when I, you know, this was when I wasn't working. I'd get home from school and I would, you know, we would, me and my mother would watch Mario Batali's, you know, when he still had a show on. And it was so great. That show to me
was Molto Mario.
It was so great. Yeah. And we would, I would watch shows like Great Chefs of the World.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember that show. Mm-hmm. That show was the best.
Took you around the world.
It did. And what I loved about that is that everybody looked the same, whether they're in Germany or Austria or France or Sweden or Italy. You know, even when they're in the States, they had different dishes.
Mm-hmm.
But you would always look at the chef and be like, oh, he's in whites. He's in chef whites. He's got a hat. He's got a toque on. He's got an apron on. And he's using the same tools. And it fascinated me, I guess. So, like, it's all the same, but they're all cooking different things.
Yeah.
Like, so it really kind of, I don't know, changed my point of view on that.
So what did your parents think when you wanted to be a chef?
My mom was all for it. My dad was like, oh, my God, I can't believe I can't believe I came to the States, worked as hard as I did, and now you want to work harder than I've ever, you know, you're going to work just as hard, if not harder than I did.
What did your father do?
He's a boilermaker. So he fixes, like, industrial-sized boilers and really, really hard work. I mean, I'd those days I'd come home and my dad was just
And what did they want up. You to be? A doctor?
My dad just wanted us to have an easier life. You know, because my parents both have lived fairly rough lives.
Mm.
Tough. Not rough, but just, you know, a little bit more difficult than what we've had to go through. So I think that, you know, everybody's vision is that their child has it easier.
Right.
You know, but I don't know, I mean, for me, they were my inspiration. My mom and my dad were to see how hard they worked. I was like, well, I could never sit behind a desk. I couldn't do that. Like, working with my hands and being creative, I think is... But more importantly, working hard. Like, I like work. Like, I like to work.
Were they surprised that you were so drawn to food? Or did they know from the time you were little and you were making your apple pancakes that...
I think my mother knew from my mom's side, because we would share those times. It'd be like 2 hours where we would literally just watch, like, cooking show after cooking show after cooking show and talk about, like, how you know, that looks interesting, this looks interesting. You know, I would buy Gourmet magazine and... We would look at the recipes together, and so there was already something there.
Mm. So that's good. So when you got to cooking school, was it a shock?
Oh yeah, complete shock. Complete shock. I had no idea what I was getting myself into.
Why? What did school do?
When I got to CIA, there had to be you had to work in a professional kitchen for 6 to 8 months minimum.
Right.
And I'd worked in a restaurant, but like not back of the house. Like I was like. I was a server at a pancake, it was a
Walker Brothers Pancake House.
Yeah.
What was it called?
Walker Brothers Pancake House.
Okay.
It's a pretty famous pancake house out in the suburbs.
It had your eyes open to what the industry is like.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I, you know, they never gave me a shot at the back of the house, so they're just like, hey, listen, kid, we'll sign this letter and say that you did it. You know, good luck and God bless. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool with me. So I went, you know, shipped me off to culinary school, and I was like.
What was the biggest shock? About a professional restaurant or a professional back of the house. But, you know, there's a lot of people who love to cook and they think, oh, I'm going to be a chef or I could be a chef. But what was the biggest shock for you?
It wasn't the amount of work. For me, I've always been fairly coordinated. Mm-hmm. For me, it was not getting it right the first time. And that was just like, to me, was like, oh my God, I can't believe like, like, I would literally freak out if my brunoise was, like, not perfect. And
those are those little chop things for people who don't know what brunoise is.
Yeah, this is the little dices. And the knife work that I felt like I'm more coordinated than... I mean, I always walk into... Like, I mean, most chefs, you walk in and you say, I'm better than these guys are. And I would walk in the kitchen and I say, I think I'm the most coordinated person here. As a matter of fact, I know I'm the most coordinated person here. And you couldn't... I didn't nail it perfectly. I think it was okay. But, like, on my first... How hard I had to get there. Hard I had to work to get to, like, work on.
It truly makes you appreciate Jacques Pepin.
Oh, for
the
sure.
The Zen master of the knife. He really is.
It's, like, flawless when you see him do it.
And it's so fast. You know, I watch chefs watch him because that's how good he is. But getting back to you, this is... So that's an excellent observation in that it took... So did you enjoy your time at the CIA?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. I mean, I was really young. I mean, I graduated high school when I was 17, so I was 18, you know, when I went to culinary school, I was 18, and in hindsight, I was fairly young to do that process.
Yeah.
I wouldn't change it right now, but definitely if I was older, I'm sure I would have taken a lot more out of it. Like, at 18, you're easily swayed into saying generic things like, I'm not a pastry chef, so I don't care about pastries. I'm going to get through it. And in hindsight, it's like, hey, dude, that's what you should be doing because that's what you're weakest at. That's right. What you should focus on, things like bread and pastries, because the cooking part, if you love to do that and it comes more naturally to you, then it's easier, you know, it's easy to learn. But these pastry ideas of pastry and doing these things are they're not normal to you. So focus on them more. It's like, you know, like an athlete. If you're a basketball player, you don't shoot free throws well, practice free throws.
Right.
So for me, that was, in hindsight, that's what I would have done different.
That's a very good piece of advice.
You have to work on the things you're not good at.
Well, that's great. Well, we have to take a break here. And sure. When we come back, we're going to talk about how you took that and ran with it.
Thanks.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Okay, welcome back. And a little shout-out to Andrew White. That's his guitar playing. I met him up in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Great place. And today we're talking, this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and you're listening to Chef Story, and we're talking to Dale Talday, one of the brightest and hottest chefs in New York City at the moment. And I should say, not from the Manhattan borough, he's from the Brooklyn borough. Right. We've just kind of talked about his early life and his first stages of getting his knife skills. So you started your journey as a young chef actually in a grill house, right?
Oh, yeah. I worked at Outback Steakhouse. It was my first job out of culinary school.
What was that like? Did you expect to work at an Outback, or did you want to go work at a fancy restaurant?
I have to be honest with you. I had no idea what I wanted to do when I left culinary school. I just needed to know I needed to decompress for like 3 months to kind of like get my mind right.
Yeah.
And after 3 months, my mom
was like, because the school was so hard and pressure? And
I think so. I think there was just a lot of like missing home, you know, you see all your friends and all your homeboys are like in college and they're doing things, and like you just missed 2 years of this and you're like, man, like, you know, I want to catch up with you guys. And it was really just 3 months of me catching up with all my friends,
right?
And then after that, I was like, my mom's like, well, you've done a really great job at blowing whatever money that you've had saved up, and you're cut off, so go get a job. And I was like, I don't know what I want to do. I need some money. So I went to go work. I was like, just looked at the ad and I was like, Outback Steakhouse. Boom. Got it.
Okay. So what did they put you on the line right away?
They put me on the line right away. Big mistake on their end.
Really?
I was terrible.
Why? You came out of culinary school. Oh, you didn't know how to
that,
work
I think
the
that's
line?
The biggest misconception. Is
Let's
that,
talk about that. Go into it. Why, what didn't you, I mean, they put you on the line. What was it like?
I mean, people will laugh at that experience. It is a busy restaurant. Outback Steakhouses in like northwest suburbs of Chicago were open at 5, done at 10. You know, they crammed.
How many steaks?
There's no way they let me even near temping steaks.
Okay.
That was a mistake. That was a great decision on their end. I worked like saute, where I just made pastas and, you know, like cooked chicken breast. And I was just, chicken breast came back. It's not cooked all the way. And it was like terribly not cooked up. You know, it was like horrendously raw. I mean, I was bad. I was a bad line cook. I wasn't a professional at the point, you know. There's no way I shouldn't have been called a professional. I mean, I should have been, like, on Fry Station. But it was, you know, they put me where they needed me, and it was just it was a learning experience for
so
sure.
So how did you get to be here today on this show? What was the learning process?
How
long does it take? Because people don't know out there. They think, you know, I've made dinner for 40 people, you know, for a birthday celebration. Everyone loved it, said it was the best thing they ever had. I could be a chef in a flash. You went to the Culinary Institute of America, spent 2 years there, graduated, and you go to Outback, and you're failing miserably. Sending out a raw chicken, or, you know, multiple times. Where is that disconnect, and what really happens? How do people progress?
I think it's one.
Should you have gone to cooking school?
Oh, of course, I should have gone to cooking school. I think cooking school is an amazing experience.
So then, why couldn't you cook a chicken breast?
I mean, it was experience. I never worked in a professional. Cooking school is awesome. It lays the foundation down, but experience, constantly working at, you know, constant repetition, continually making something over and over and over again.
Okay, so in culinary school, if they gave you a chicken to cook, you probably could have cooked it.
Sure.
But at Outback, it went out not cooked. Where is the difference? I think that's what people want to understand.
It's also multitasking. It's you're cooking 7 dishes at one time while another set of orders are being called to you. And you have to do it the same way every single time. Well, you know, if you're cooking at a dinner party at home, you're like, well, I'm gonna lay out my list of things to do, and the lasagna will get made the day before, and then I'll put that in 2 hours before it gets made, and then I'll make the salad, and then I'll dress it right before, you know, everyone sits down. I'll have my canapes all laid out. Everyone will have a cocktail when they get in. It'll be great. And it's not like
that
in a professional kitchen.
So, yeah, you have control. But then when you get into a professional kitchen, it's the customer that has the control, the timing control.
Of course, because you don't know. I want a chicken, no cheese, add tomatoes. Okay. Then I want another chicken regular. I need 2 more chickens regular. I need another chicken, you know, no
salt.
And
while you're cooking this, the orders are coming in.
Yeah,
and people are screaming for the orders to go out. So it's an organizational job, probably, mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. much as anything else.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it's almost like the stock exchange.
Really?
If you can hear these repetitive, if you can multitask and hear and do something, you know, hear something being barked in your ear and continue to work and remember what was yelled in your ear, that's kind of a skill set that school never really fully teaches you. I mean, it's really something that you have to get into a kitchen and you have to have your, you know, the chef barking down on you, the sous chef barking down on you. You know, other cooks relying on you to be
right.
Other cooks are relying on you to be just as good. There's a lot of pressure because there's a lot of people who are relying on you to do your job.
Right. You know, you're on Top Chef. So Tom Colicchio worked at Burger King. That was one of his first jobs. And he really went back and said, you know, I respected that experience because you have to be organized, you know, with
absolutely.
The heat and the volume you have to put out. Okay, let's move on to the more fun. What was it like working at Morimoto?
Oh, it was a great experience. I mean, Chef Morimoto is a...
he's one of my favorites.
Yeah, he's a real restaurateur, a real professional. Probably one of the best guys on the sushi line you will ever see. His hands move so fast, it almost looks like someone's, like you're watching it at DVR and then you just hit fast forward like 4 times. His hands are so fast. And that's one of the things that you look at this guy and you know that he's done this just a million times. And it's that fast. I'm telling you, if you sit at the sushi bar, wherever he's working, he's not lost a step.
Really?
He is so fast, so quick, so precise.
So in which of these, was there any one restaurant where you had a transcendental moment saying, I got it?
Yeah.
Where was that?
Yeah, it was one of my restaurants in Chicago called Naha. And let me tell you, I partied pretty hard when I was a kid. You know,
I can't believe it.
Well, yeah, you know, rolled a joint before I went to work for a while. And when you get to a point in your life and you say, something is just not clicking. I can never get set up. I always feel behind. I'm just not. And I kind of I'd made a decision. I'm not going to do this anymore before. I respect them too much to.
Who is them?
Oh, Carrie and Michael Nahabedian. They're two of my mentors.
Mm-hmm.
But I respect Carrie too much because she cares too much about her business and her food and us.
Mm.
So I stopped doing that. And it really was like, it's like the light got turned on, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I was so much more prepared for service. I was so much like more involved. It was, you know, it really clicked about being a family and in a restaurant instead of being in this haze of like, I'm constantly behind, not knowing what I'm doing. So that's when, for me, I stopped partying and I was like,
How big a team was it?
It was probably about 10 guys in the kitchen. You know, it was a meat, an entremet, fish, grill, two in garmage, two in pastry, and then her sous chef, and then two dishwashers. So, yeah.
How many covers a night would you do?
Kind of busy night, we'd probably do 180. That was pushing. Mm. But it was high end. It was very fine dining.
Where was your favorite place to work, other than there?
Budokan really was this moment where I, because learning how to cook is one thing, learning how to be a restaurateur and a chef, I think, are two totally different things. Like learning how to be a chef, you have to sit there, especially if, you know, owning your own restaurant isn't something you want to do. You have to learn how to take criticism from the owners, because ultimately, as much as you think you're the boss, the minute this person walks into the door, he's the boss. The minute your director, the director of operations, your GM walk through the door, they're your boss. Whether you're, a sous chef or the executive chef, these people are your boss. So, you know, we would do tastings at the restaurant with Steven, and to his credit, it was an amazing experience.
Steven Starr, the owner of Budokan and Morimoto.
And a bunch of different restaurants. He would say to the sous chef and chef team, I want a monkfish dish. I'm not going to give you any direction. I want eight of, because which was a large management staff at Budokan, I want eight different monkfish dishes. And we would sit at a table and eight dishes would come out, and he would just tear people apart. This is terrible. This is not good. This is whatever. He would have servers and hostesses come in and taste the food. And so
Top Chef was easy after Steven Starr.
For me,
get criticism.
Oh my God. I mean, for me, taking criticism at that point was like, I've done a lot. You guys don't pay my bills. You don't write my checks. Steven does. So
yeah.
It was pretty easy.
So when did you go on Top Chef the first time? Where were you working?
I was at Budokan. I just got to Budokan when I got there, when I was on the show the first time.
So what's that like? What propelled you to want to do that?
You know, it was really an ex-girlfriend that got me onto the show, who mm-hmm. like got me into watching it. And then she's like, hey, you should apply for this show. It's a great show. And then my sous chef staff, all my cooks at Morimoto, at the time I was at Morimoto, they're like, hey, you should go for the show. You're a lunatic. And I was like, okay. So I walked in, and it was a cold call, and I walked in and said, hey, I'd like to try out for this. And
what's the trial like?
It was really more of a conversation. It was just like an interview.
They didn't watch you cook. Mm-hmm. So they had no idea how good you were.
They don't know how good or bad you were, but they did have your resume, and they did a thorough check on like, hey, does this guy do this? Does he do that? Does he do this at the restaurant? And they checked your background.
So they're looking for your personality.
I think at first they were, they definitely were at first looking for your personality. There's a way for them to look at your food.
Mm-hmm.
They just, you know, they can find your food.
So then did Budokan have to give you the time off to go do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long did it take to tape the shows?
It took about 5.5 weeks. If you make it all the way.
Yeah.
I think now it really depends on like the shooting schedule. But, you know, ours, I was gone for about 5.5 weeks.
Wow. What city did they pick when you went?
I was in Chicago the first time.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you were sort of home territory.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I went back home. And it was a good feeling to be back home. But, you know, you're committed to the show. It's your sequester.
Oh,
this is what you do. Just like, there's no like, hey, I'm in town.
Well, we're going to get into the show, but we have to take another break.
Sure.
We'll be coming right back.
Okay.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton from the International Culinary Center. And we're sitting in Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today I'm talking to Dale Talday, who has three Brooklyn restaurants. But before we get to them, we were in the middle of Top Chef, and you tried out, and you made it, and they were doing it in Chicago. How tough is it? Is it as tough as it looks?
It's tougher.
Tell us. Tell us the backstory.
I mean, it's every day. Imagine going to work and either getting a promotion and more money or just getting fired every day. It's really based on decisions.
It's really much easier the first show than last.
No, the first show was tougher by far. I thought it was because you don't know what to expect. You don't know how to sleep. You don't know a sleeping schedule. You don't know. They don't tell you anything. And, you know, on the second time around, they're not going to treat you like people who've just been on the show because you know kind of the ins and outs. So they're going to give you a little bit of a break on it. And they take care of you a little bit better.
Was it obvious to you who was not going to make the cut?
The first time around, yes. There was you look in someone's eye and you're just like, oh my, you look lost. Like, you for real look lost. I mean, there really has to be a competitive edge.
Mm-hmm.
You have to walk in with a swagger. Like, I belong here. And not only do I belong here, I'm going to kick everybody's butt to get to the top. And some people just didn't have that. Like, they were a little bit shy. I mean, that can also work against you, but got to have that swagger when you come into these shows because, you know, a lack of confidence will destroy you.
In the first Top Chef you were in, mm-hmm. was everybody a professional or were there amateurs, just good amateur cooks?
No, at that point everybody was a professional. And anytime you see that person, if you ever see it, and I don't think they'll do it anymore, but anytime you ever see, like, hi, I'm a culinary student, and I know they look at me like I'm the baby. I'm the baby and I'm the worst, but I'll show everybody. They're gone.
Yeah.
Automatic.
Why is that?
They can't hang. There's no way. The challenges they give are so tough that if you're a new cook, an amateur, there's no way. I mean, there's like, if you think about this, professionals that have been cooking for 20 years that can't achieve some of these challenges.
Wow. So what do you think was the hardest technique given to you on that show?
It's always the speed versus volume.
Mm.
So it's like...
But you're always doing like 4 or 6 dishes, right? For the judges.
Yes, but it's not like the quick fires to me were not a problem. Like the cook one dish. It's the cook one dish for 300 people in 2 hours.
Oh, that's right.
To me, those are always the toughest because it's like, you know, it's the worry of execution. It's the worry about making it taste good. It's the logistics of it all. And then, you know, when it's speed or time, quantity, and then transportation, all three of those kind of like mixed into one. It's like that.
They don't figure transportation for you.
You figure transportation, but you have to pack your stuff, get it there, unpack it, and then execute.
And execute it at the right temperature.
Exactly. So like in those instances, those are always the toughest because it's, you know, you're always pressed for time. It's you're worried.
What'd you think of the judges? Did you think that they were qualified to judge?
Oh yeah. I mean, most of the times they were. I mean, when it's Tom and Gail and Padma and, you know, when it's all these judges, you know, Hugh Atchison, their palates have been eaten around the world. They know what food is.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you, in your mind's eye, you think, oh, they're not going to tell me. And then someone like Padma will say, did you toast all these spices? And you're like, I didn't. Mm. And you're like, oh, she just caught me. And they don't see the video of it. Mm-hmm. They just know. They will just taste it. Mm-hmm. And like Tom will say, oh, that was a really uneven sear. And you're like, man, I know. It really was. It was a really uneven sear.
Well, that's great. I mean, it's amazing how a professional tastes food versus
an amateur.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then you made All Stars.
Yep.
How did that make you feel?
I mean, it was great. It was a great opportunity for redemption. I mean, I think, you know, for all of us who have gotten kicked off, it's always like, man, this is what I would have done different. And then you actually never thought that opportunity of like being able to do something, to, you know, to get on again and prove yourself would happen. And, you know, it was a pretty good experience. It was amazing that they actually chose me. I was honored.
Real? No, well, you're proving it out. So let's get to your restaurants. Yes. Tell me, 3 restaurants in 1 year. Did you plan it to be 3? So tell us how they all unfolded. Talde came first?
Yeah, so Talde came first. Then, you know, like when I got off All Stars, I said to myself, this is my opportunity. I was working a great job with Steven Starr, you know, director of Asian Concepts, traveling around, creating dishes, kind of being like, you know, the point person on, you know, how things should be done with the food. And then I just said to myself, you know, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to try and get my own restaurant. So I met up my business partners, David and John. They had a restaurant already called Thistle Hill Tavern. And I said to them, hey, you guys want to partner up and do something? And we were all like, yeah, you know, we all kind of liked each other. We all thought each other's personalities gelled well. So we decided to open Talde. We got that open January 15th of
2012.
And, you know, like, at the same time, not the same time, but...
So tell me about that menu. What was the concept behind that restaurant?
The concept, it really morphed. I mean, it changed a bunch of times. I mean, we didn't know what to call it, and we did understand that if you call, you know, it's like one of those things where if you don't know what to call the food in, like, two words, people lose interest in New York City. If it's like, you have to tell someone what the food is, and it's an elaborate sentence, people are like, nah, I think I just want Mexican.
Yeah.
I think I just want Italian.
Right.
So for
each 3 syllables,
exactly. So for us, we had to call it something, and calling it Modern Asian was kind of like our fallback. Like, I don't know what to call it. It's not really going to be this. So I credit this to my PR guy. He was just like, hey, why don't we call it who you are? Why don't we call the food what your culture is? You're an Asian American. Let's call it that. Cause that's where the point of view is. That's the POV of the restaurant. And we're like, all right, let's do it. And then it kind of took off from there. Like, the restaurant, Talde, is food that kind of comes from where I'm from. So it's really great Korean food, Vietnamese, Filipino, because these are all the neighbors and like all my friends are these. Filipino food, Vietnamese, Korean, Thai, and then with the kind of a distinct, you know, American point of view.
So describe a dish that you think really expresses that.
Sure. So I think for us it's like the bacon pad Thai. With crispy oysters. So for us, it was like kind of this trip of like, I love oysters. Oh, I love pad thai. It's one of my favorite like kind of hangover foods. It's like one of my favorite noodle dishes.
Yeah.
So I took it and I thought, okay, hangover brunch. It's one of my favorite brunch foods. So if it's one of my favorite brunch foods already, bacon. The bacon and the egg that are in the pad thai already, they go. So we went there. And then to me, I was just like, well, we're on the East Coast. Beautiful Blue Point oysters and bacon going well together. So we just fried some crispy oysters on top, and it's just how the dish came together. I think that kind of epitomizes kind of what we do there. It's at heart a traditional dish, and then we just kind of put our American point of view into it.
So how did the second restaurant come about?
Oh, this was nuts. I mean, a very good friend of ours, Judith, she let us know that one of the restaurants on Fifth Avenue that's not too far from Talde.
Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, yes. One of the owners and who was a landlord of the building was a restaurant called Aunt Susie. She was retiring, and she still owned the building, so she was going to kind of handpick her successor. She wasn't going to put the restaurant
on. Now, this is just a few months later after you opened Talde.
When we signed the restaurant, we were not even open yet.
Oh, my gosh. So when you signed the second restaurant?
When we signed the second restaurant, we were 2 days away from being open, and I was in a daze going, I cannot believe we're going to do this. But we had talked to the landlord, and she gave us, you know, she saw us, met us, ate at Thistle Hill Tavern because that was already open, and she said, you know what, you guys are great guys. If you're interested, I'd love to give you guys, you know, the keys to the restaurant. So we worked out a deal, and luckily we had investors that were really psyched, and we had 2 days from opening. We were sitting there in the lawyer's office signing and getting keys to the next restaurant, and I was like, I can't believe we're doing this. and it just kind of happened. It happened from there.
So how did you get enough cooks? And you have to train 2 kitchens.
We knew that the build out that we had on the second restaurant was going to take 6 months, to 8 months. So we already started hiring. We found the chef. We let everybody know what was going on. We started, and I mean, we were 6 guys at Talde, 7 guys, 2 dishwashers, eight guys, two dishwashers, a morning and a night guy, one garmage guy, me, my now chef de cuisine, Andrew, and my two other sous chefs, Kyle and Janine, and that was it. We had nobody
else. How many seats in the restaurant?
65 seats in the dining room, 12 seats at the bar.
Oh, my gosh. So how many covers a night on Saturday?
At night, we push about 180. And all day, though, 200. All day, we're doing about, with brunch and dinner now, we're doing about four and some change.
With how many in the kitchen?
We have a lot more now. So yeah, we have a lot more.
Is the kitchen
now.
Big?
We've doubled. It's a tiny kitchen. We've doubled the amount of staff that we've had. We probably have like 18 back of the house employees, wow. Cooks, dishwashers. I mean, you know, right. It's an army.
Right. So, okay. So the second one was Pork Slope?
Second restaurant was Pork Slope.
I love the name.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like this funny, like, you know, like we should open a barbecue restaurant. And it's really how it happened. We were kind of like in the middle of putting Taldi together. And I was
this
like,
is at Aunt Mary's or whatever.
Aunt Susie's. Yeah.
Aunt Susie's.
This old Aunt
Susie's.
So Susie
now Pork Slope. Yeah. Pork Slope is Aunt Susie's mm-hmm. space. Okay.
So we were kind of sitting down, you know, talking. And I said, hey, it would be funny if we opened a barbecue restaurant called Pork Slope in Park Slope. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, everybody just went, everybody's eyes lit up. We closed the door and we're like, no one leaves until we hash this out. No one talk about this. Mm. And we kind of put it down on paper what it should be and what it was going to be to us. Mm. And, you know, dreaming stages. But, you know, like I took cues from like my favorite movie, John Patrick Swayze's Roadhouse. That was like my favorite movie. It still is. So like that was one of the inspirations, like, you know, the dive bars that I grew up going to as a kid were inspiration. So we all kind of drew from that. And, you know, we wanted to have a bar that we can go to after Taldi that was not Asian food. Because, like, I've been doing almost entirely Asian food my entire life. So it's like whenever I leave Taldi, I want a burger.
So did you totally craft the menu or were other people involved too?
At
Pork Slope.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, it really was my team at Taldi. We all were like, hey, what would you like to see it? What do you want to eat at night? And, you know, I love tater tots. We'd have no fries. It's just tater tots. You know, we did a great burger, like a bar burger, pulled pork sandwiches, brisket, you know, slow smoked brisket, ribs. Now we have great nachos. We got Roto for our nachos. And, you know, we have a burger, a burrito program at Pork Slope.
What do you mean a burrito program?
Well, it's kind of like do-it-yourself burrito or, like, you know, choose your own adventure burrito. So we lay on a foundation of, like, Spanish rice, beans, pickled jalapenos. People put, like, we have barbecue. We have, like, buffalo shrimp. So people do, like, an order of buffalo shrimp, and we put that inside the burrito, lettuce, guajillo sauce, then we roll it up, cheese on top of that. Or people have done fried chicken, like fried chicken, breaded fried chicken that we have. And then last week, my sous chef did a cheeseburger in it, like a whole cheeseburger
in a burrito.
In a burrito.
That is the first I've ever. Okay, so then, are you crazy, Thistle Hill?
So
tell
then,
me about that.
So then, my business partners—they had this restaurant already. They were going through a couple chefs, and it was
this
always
is the third restaurant in 2012. This was like October, right?
This is October. So I would always see that them. You know, we would have owners meetings, and then they was like, hey, now we got to talk about Thistle. And I'd be like, okay, now I'm going to go do what I need to do. And it felt weird, like, hey, we're not all doing this together. Even though I would give them advice, hey, you know what, this is what you guys should do with some of the dishes there at the food. And I would give them advice on it, and it just became like this moment where, like, we all should just partner up because it seems silly that we're not involved, even though I want to be involved and help you guys with your own restaurant because, you know, you guys seem so, like, stressed about it.
So it sounds like you've morphed from being a chef into being more a business chef overseeing that. How much do you get to cook anymore?
I mean, I think those are the bright spots in our day.
When you can jump
when
on
I can
the line.
Jump in the line and actually make something, or I get creative and like have this idea. You know, when it's not just checking the email, writing emails about like I need line cooks. When it's not making sure that your numbers at these restaurants are working out, that you're writing schedules.
So do you feel you are a chef? But
always.
Do you feel more like a manager? You know, a chef is a manager.
Sure.
But what percentage of your day is chef and what percentage is manager?
I think my
or
day will...
creative.
It's for me 50-50. But managing the creativity aspect of it, if you don't empower your sous, your sous chef, your chef de cuisine, if you don't empower them to start like really being creative, then you're doing a disjustice.
Service.
Yeah, to these guys, because they need that. What that's what needs to spur them.
Right.
That makes them a better chef. Mm-hmm. Like I can teach them how to work on my food cost, even though I'm not great at it. I can teach them how to manage cooks and tell them how to, you know, how to talk to cooks and how to motivate. But that part is from within. They have to find their own voice. They have to find their own palate about how they like to cook and taste food. So that's,
wow.
Yeah.
I have you know what? We're in a container in Roberta's in Brooklyn where this radio show is. And I think they're doing the spring planting above on
nice.
The roof. So, well, anyway, this I can't wait to, I want to go taste that cheeseburger burrito.
I do, too. I saw my sous chef eat it.
Did you
like,
eat it?
I don't think I have the guts for that right now. I mean, I saw him eat it. I was like, dude, are you really going to take that down? And he's like, yeah, man, I'm doing it. Yeah, at that point, he had a couple whiskeys in him, and that's kind of place Pork Slope is, but I was like, all right, God bless, man. Good
all
luck.
Right.
Let me know.
Well, you know what? All I have to say, Dale, it's April 2013. You haven't opened a restaurant yet.
No,
what's happening?
We're taking 2013. We're going to take a break this year and really focus on the restaurants and making them as good as they're making their full potential, and then hopefully in 2014, we'll open up with a big bang.
Wow. Well, thanks for fitting into your very busy schedule, you know, stopping
Absolutely.
By and talking to us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having
okay.
me.
You're very welcome. And shout out to Jack Inslee and Robin Cohen. Thanks a lot for your production help. And this is Dorothy Cann Hamilton. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.